Hi, I am Takuma Sato. You're listening F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you are not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. Nasser Hamid will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the program. This is podcast number 482, January 20th, 2011. Stephen?
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Google Ads. Google Ads bring you the Formula One experience, or maybe karting school. Click on them, you know you want to.
Thank you, Stephen. On today's program, Nico Hülkenberg still without a ride. Do you know the way to Manicourt? La 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 la. Fozzie leaves Lotus and goes to Lotus. And of course, Motorsports Mondial with Nasser Hamid, and special repeat interview this week with the great Tony Brooks. Stephen, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Wonderful, Mr. Rogers. And yourself?
Absolutely great. You know, we're finally getting into it. Some news is coming out. Launch dates.
It's getting closer.
And, you know, still a lot of talk about the 1.6-liter turbo engines coming into 2013. Some people love it. Some people don't.
Earth-moving equipment in Austin.
And I will read a little bit more about the end of the 1.5-liter formula that died in 1965 when, in 66, they went with bigger motors.
Room.
Yes, so, but what I liked about the 1.5 liter formula in 1965 is they said, okay, that was your limit in CCs, but you could do as many cylinders as you wanted. And that I thought was intriguing, and that's why we had variety of different 1.5 liter motors and even a V16.
Wow.
So it's...
Man, I'm thinking 1.5 liter displacement with 16... It's like...
They're small.
Tiny-ass cylinders.
But still, you get some great, great innovation, great engineering, and it's very interesting. So that's what I think we should be heading into. More innovation and not necessarily limiting them to four cylinders. And that's... Ferrari's V6... was a small V6, but still exciting.
Yeah, I would like to see them open it up and make it more of a framework rather than a hard specification. But that's, you know, I really like the idea that Max Mosley had a couple of years back. Go, hey, you get X number of gallons of gas. Build a motor to finish the race.
Yes, it's very interesting. I mean, even Honda in 65 had a 12-cylinder 1.5-liter.
I
know it's hard to fathom.
Yeah, I just have a hard time picturing that motor.
But it can be done, Stephen.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it can. But it's kind of like the V12s that we love so much in in 1/12 scale.
Absolutely. Anyway, there you have it. Group Lotus, I believe, or Renault Lotus GP just announced that their reserve driver for the 2011 season will be Farouz Fozzie, and he's been around for a while. I believe Nasser has interviewed him, and he was at Team Lotus
last year,
and now he's at Group Lotus. Obviously, I believe him being Malaysian has everything to do with this.
It has quite a bit to do with it. I was actually almost expecting that Romain Grosjean might sneak in there and get that reserve role because Bouillon was out earlier in the week. or last week talking him up.
Exactly.
He should have a seat on the grid kind of thing.
He's been in and out of the F1 news, and even Nasser thinks that he should get a comeback somewhere.
Another opportunity anyway.
But right now we've got too many people.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest problem. But there you have it. Farus Fozzi representing Malaysia is back with Group Lotus, not Team Lotus, Stephen. And he's also competing.
Just go Lotus Renault, please. Yeah. You're confusing me with the Group Lotus and Team Lotus.
Well, we'll bring that up later on. But he'll be also competing in the GP2 series this year with Supernova.
Supernova.
Not with Lotus ART. But there you have it.
It's going to be that guy. Can't tell the players without a scorecard.
Well, it's a little bizarre. Good news with Pirelli. They've been doing some wet testing.
Woohoo.
Pedro De La Rosa at the helm. And they've been listening to Herr Schumacher and some of the other drivers. And they've been changing the front, this construction of the front tire. It's very interesting. Pirelli says, we were asked to provide a slightly stronger front tire, which is what we've done. In the process, we maybe threw the rear out of balance, which is something that was noted during the test, but we've also improved that during the remaining tests that we've participated in. We were asked to try to beef up the front tires by Michael Schumacher to give it more precise input when the driver turns into the corner, to give more feel. We believe we've done that, and we've now finished the work on the rear, so we'll see how we get on with a car designed around our tires. So that's going to be interesting. I think it's good that they're listening to the drivers, especially the big drivers.
It sounds like they're listening to one driver.
No. I put Michael Schumacher's name in there because you know he's the one who's asking this more than anybody.
Oh, yeah. He wants a tighter tire. And it makes sense. The Bridgestones back in their day when they were building for Ferrari were much stiffer than they were when they were a spec tire.
Well, especially, I mean, the tires really went through a lot of development when we had the Bridgestone Michelin War. And then, of course, when Bridgestone became the sole supplier,
they basically just stopped development, more or less.
You could call it that, but a lot of people like a static tire and where the championship is not concluded
or determined by.
Correct. So that there you go. So anyway, I think the Pirellis are going to be fairly successful this year. I think it's going to be fun. Let's move on to Nico Hülkenberg, still without a seat, which is really a sad day. GP2 champion in his rookie season. And, of course, replaced by Pastor Maldonado and... boy.
What do you know?
Boy, and they denied that he's bringing money, but boy, is he bringing money. And apparently, listen to this. Venezuelan oil sponsorship for Williams.
Oh, really? Wow. I'm so surprised.
Yes, and I'm beginning to think that Mil Kaduna will be their reserve driver eventually.
That would be interesting.
The whole Venezuelan family. And apparently, Pastor Maldonado and Chavez are just chum buddies now, drinking beers and having a good time.
He can't be drinking beer. He's going to be a race car driver. Can't drink beer.
It's low-calorie beer.
From alcohol. From fogs beer. Your brain.
Does it?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Tell me about that Pilsner you're drinking.
You mean that water I'm drinking? It's called Yveon. Thank you very much, Stephen. And
Yveon Arcade.
Yes. Thank you very much. But anyway, apparently his manager, Willie Weber, said no to Virgin Racing. He didn't want him mixing it up with another German, which is really a strange answer.
It's a really stupid answer because he's better off on the grid than he is sitting in the stands.
Yeah, and Willie Weber's answer was this. For someone like Nico, with a season already behind him, there is little to learn from a small team. There was an offer from Virgin, which was very pleasing, but with another German named Timo Glock, who has been there for a while already. The risk was too great.
What risk? That Timo's going to out race him?
I can't believe that. Timo Glock is a great driver, but Nico Hülkenberg, I think, certainly has proven himself.
Well, I think Timo's a good driver, and I think Nico has the ability to be a great driver, given the right car. I can't... Dumb. I would rather see him on the grid than see him... worried. If he's worried about not being able to outrace Timo Glock, then he has no business in Formula One.
I agree. The first thing to do is get him in a small team, outperform Timo Glock, get the big team's attention.
Again, yeah, exactly.
And that's what you have to do in this sport. But to sit there and say no to any possibilities is really ludicrous. He's also saying that we've been thinking maybe we shall pause for a year, but in today's world, you are too quickly forgotten. So I think it is better for Nico to still have a presence with a good team where at least he can practice on the Fridays. That is the deal. Alternative, the ideal alternative I'm looking for him.
And where's he going to get that?
I don't know. I still predict...
At Virgin?
No, but he could go with a bigger team like Mercedes. They still haven't replaced my friend.
Nikki?
Exactly.
Nikki Heidfeld.
Heidfeld. So it's interesting, but we'll see what happens.
I really can't see passing up on a race seat. You know, if it was a decent deal.
I agree.
And you can always, it's like any sport. You can learn.
Especially when you're at that age.
Yeah.
You start at small teams. Fernando started at Minardi. I mean, you got to go with the small teams.
You know, where did Senna start, Jordan? Or would
Tolman.
Tolman. So it's, come on. Frankly, he would have been better off at Virgin the last 2 years than
Williams.
At Williams.
Well, that's, you know, I don't know what to say, but the biggest problem is things are changing so fast in Formula One. The cars are going to be changing. Pay drivers, it seems to be dominating the sport more and more.
Well, that's because the only teams that can afford to not have paid drivers are the top teams.
And the worst part, will Nico Hülkenberg be able to attract a top drive, which is hard to do in this day and age.
It's hard to do if you're not on the track.
That's very, very true. So we'll see what happens. Interesting stuff from Martin Brundle. Of course, he will be teaming up with David Coulthard.
Coulthard.
As the main BBC team covering the Formula One races, which is going to be great. Jonathan Ledger, like everybody knows, has been... fired.
Sacked.
Well, you know, he didn't bother me too much, but occasionally he did say some idiotic things. But Martin Brundle's predicting maybe a feistier fight over at McLaren. You know, the love fest that I've spoken about
yes.
so much last year. The worst part was him and Jenson Button driving to Silverstone in the Volkswagen van. There was hugging and kissing. It was just too much. I was gagging. It was grotesque. But he's predicting that there's going to be some sparks flying. And Mr. Brundle says, I think Lewis is probably the faster of the two in absolute raw speed. But Jenson was the man who got 49 laps out of a set of tires in Abu Dhabi that most parked after 11 to 15 laps. We haven't seen them in a head-to-head. They're quite good mates, but there's no point being that much of a mate with your teammate. Or any other F1 driver, for that matter, that you are competing against. When we see them in an absolute head-to-head, I think we might find a different dynamic between the two. If you look back to Istanbul and remember Lewis face on the podium when Jenson had passed him and he wasn't expecting it, I think that's a little taster of what might happen this season. So that makes me happy. That Love Fest thing was just killing me.
I think it's going to be a Love Fest again this year. The only way that it won't be is if those are the two guys at the tip of the spear. And I don't really think that both guys will be at the tip of the spear.
Well, the first thing Martin Brundle forgot to mention is, will the McLaren be competitive?
Yeah.
Remember how the McLaren started off, especially the previous season. We'll see what happens. Because it could be Lotus... Renault.
Yeah, but, you know, was it Newey saying in Autosport today that, oh, that flexible rear end is going to make it too easy for the cars behind to pass?
We'll see about that.
It's Formula One, dude. It's never easy to pass. It hasn't been easy to pass since the 60s.
Yeah, we'll see about that flexible wing, because people are already complaining, including Felipe Massa, that they've just got too many buttons on the steering wheel. I mean, now we've got the flexible wing,
but that's and no different.
We have KERS.
Yeah, but it's two buttons instead of the one that they had last year for the front wing.
Luckily, they dropped the F-duck. Which meant
because you wouldn't have been able to
that's
hold your hand against the side of the
hand.
Dash and
unbelievable
push your KERS button.
Yeah, and I'm surprised the FIA doesn't step in because of safety issues. Watching some of the drivers drive one-handed last year was pretty bizarre. So I don't know.
They're going fast down a straight. They don't need both hands.
Yeah, I guess you're
They're strong guys anyways. They could turn that car with one arm.
You're right. Anyway, Lotus.
Power steering.
Well, they all have power steering.
So what do you need two hands for?
That's
just
true.
Use your fingertips. And
that's how I drive my Chevrolet.
Exactly.
Lotus versus Lotus. The core battle is going to start a lot earlier than everybody expected. January 24th, the matter is set to be heard in the London courts. It's pretty exciting. The legal battle over the use of the Lotus name in Formula One is to hit the courts much earlier than originally anticipated. And apparently, this is the push by Group Lotus against Team Lotus, or Behar against Fernandez, or Renault Lotus against the other Lotus that's powered by Renault. Boy, it's going to be exciting. But so we'll see what happens. January 24th, it starts. I think Group Lotus is trying to nip this in the bud and have only one Lotus team on the grid, but I think it's going to drag through the courts for a long, long time. Another problem with one of the Lotuses, and that would be Group Lotus or Renault Lotus GP, apparently that color scheme they're going with, also known as the John Player Special, is causing some problems already because of tobacco sponsorship. And apparently Canada is already bitching.
Frankly, it's a color scheme. It's not, it harkens back to a day gone by, but it's not like they're going to be putting John Player Special on the side of the car.
It won't have the John Player Special. Like you said, it's just a color scheme. But let's not forget.
And when I was a kid, I thought John Player Special was just the name of the car.
Let's not forget, Stephen, what happened to the barcode on the Ferrari. Simple barcode. See, but it's what it infers subliminally. It could... You never know what's in these paint schemes when you're looking at it. It might make you go to the tobacco shop.
Well, frankly, if they really wanted to go that direction, there'd be stuff in the swirls of the paint that you wouldn't be able to see with your naked eye that would be doing that to you anyway.
I don't know. There you have it.
It's like the ice cubes.
Canada... They already want to scrutinize the paint scheme, and it's questionable whether the gold and black scheme that hints of John Player cigarettes will be allowed in Canada.
Okay, so we're going to make the Ferrari change its colors too?
The Ferrari's just red. Red infers what, Stephen?
Red, white, and black is what it is, and that infers their sponsor, who actually came out and said that they might be back for a couple more years.
Marlboro.
Yes.
Of course. That's big bucks. Good news for moi, Stephen.
For moi?
Do you know the way to Manicourt?
Doesn't mean that Bernie does.
Well, apparently, they've got a nice new motorway.
Out to Manicourt.
Yeah, from Paris to Manicourt.
Have they built any hotels around the track yet?
They will. Construction work began on the Nevers South Manicourt Moirie section of road in 2008, with users having first driven on the new tarmac on Monday morning. That would be last week. The motorway is now set to be officially inaugurated by the Premier of Burgundy.
Is that like a governor?
A hipster gets free Burgundy.
the premier. He basically runs around and cuts ribbons and kisses babies.
Nah, he probably gets a little nookie on the side too, but you know, it sounds, you know,
free wine. Is he a free wine?
Of course,
I'm up for it. Let's
I'm
go.
Telling you,
you and I should become premiers. In
yeah.
France.
Well, I, you know, I'm the Duke of Dijon, so I get free mustard. Anyway, you know, and this is really getting annoying for me. Pedro de la Rosa, who's younger than Michael Schumacher, by the way. But the 39-year-old Spaniard who was replaced by Nick Heidfeld for the last five races last season and, of course, took over the Pirelli testing from Nick Heidfeld, who was doing the Pirelli testing, so did a little swapper. But apparently he's turning down HRT's offer. He says, quote, "I don't know what the future will cover. I'm trying to find a race drive in Formula One, as always. I will never give up. Pirelli are planning to do some more testing during the year. I don't know. Possibly I will be returning with Pirelli, a race drive somewhere, or a reserve role in Formula One would be great. The next few weeks will be quite important for my future."
So what was the role he was offered at HRT?
I have no clue. He says he turned it down, though. But I didn't know officially...
Was it a race drive?
I don't know. I didn't see anything official, but it makes sense. Spanish team. They're possibly getting Telefonica sponsorship. They are doing pretty good. Obviously, Telefonica would want a Spanish driver. They're certainly not going to get a Fernando Alonso. I think Pedro de la Rosa might have one more year in him. But let's face it. Let's remember, he was replaced by Nick Heidfeld at Sauber for a reason.
Yeah.
He was stinko.
Yes, he was not very consistent.
No, I mean, Kobayashi, that's what we're looking for.
Not only that, excitement. But I don't know that I want to race drive at HRT, because if some kid from GP2 walks in with, you know, a pocket full of money, you're sitting on the bench.
And that's what's going on, and I think HRT should be looking for drivers with money, because they need that at their stage of development. They don't need a star driver, they need paid drivers.
Exactly. And Pedro's not a star. You know, you can get the talent that Pedro has out of a youngster with some cash.
Absolutely. So there you have it, Stephen. Now stay tuned for a fantastic interview. Of course, we're talking the great Tony Brooks, another great conversation with Nasser Hamid. And, of course, that'll be right after Motorsports Mondial. We'll be back after this brief message.
F1Weekly.com would like to thank our sponsor, San Jose Label Inc. San Jose Label is a custom manufacturer of labels that makes a variety of products. 1-4 color process labels, alphanumeric barcoding and UPC labels, blank labels, serialized asset tags, hazardous labels, bumper stickers, pin feed, static cling, hot stamp labels, and many others. Please go to www.sanjoselabel.com for info, samples requests, and graphic design. Or you can call to telephone 408-436-8221. San Jose Label is the one-stop shop for all your labeling needs.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Greetings and racing regards. Today we have news from the sands of Atacama to snow in the Alps. And you know what I'm talking about, Mr. Rogers. Success, major success for Arabian Night in South America, the Dakar Rally, and Monte Carlo Rally gets going in Europa, which is along with the Safari Rally and, of course, now Dakar, one of my top three rallying events. And we have some driver signing updates also, and plus some rumor mill information. First, we take Braniff International all the way to Buenos Aires in coach class. for the third South American running. This was the third, I was not able to verify. This was the third running in South America, right? If I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
Yeah, okay.
But somebody will let us know.
Oh, I'm sure. Third successive win for Vita, Volkswagen, and the Touareg SUV. Different driver each time, so which is good. Major breakthrough win for Middle East Motorsports, and this is very, very good for them. My distant cousin, see, I have one distant cousin in Qatar and one in Sao Paulo, Felipe Nasser. So, maybe I have some motorsports. I may not have racing in my eyes, but I may have some in my genes. Anyway,
did you say in your genes?
Yeah, Levi F501. Maybe Wrangler. They used to sponsor Dale Earnhardt in, or somebody in NASCAR. Maybe in my Wrangler. There you go.
Not Neff Neff?
Yeah, no. Okay, where are we? My distant cousin, Nasser Al-Athiyah from Qatar, or Qatar as the natives would call, was the winner. The highlight of my career, as the winner described it, last year he was second. Nasser Al-Athiyah is 40 years old and in 2006 won the production class title in the 2006 World Rally Championship. So this is not winning by luck. I mean, he was very competitive last year and has done very well in other sporting events too. In second place, 49 minutes behind, was his South African teammate Geniel de Villiers. Interesting name there. Al-Athiyah is... I already read this line. Okay, it's once again a double... It's double vision. Excuse me, moi. Carlos Sainz, winner of the event last year, was the early leader but ran into sand dunes. Sand dunes are not only in Sahara, but they're also in South America. He won the final stage of the rally to finish third. My man, Robbie Gordon, one of my all-time favorite motorsports driver, Orange County's finest, was disqualified after losing about 5 hours with a wheel bearing issue. He was piloting a Hummer sponsored by Speed Energy, and I believe Speed Energy is owned by Robbie Gordon himself. This is a massive racing talent.
Yeah, he ran into some problems in the early stages. I believe he flipped it and just completely beat the crap out of his poor truck, and from there on he was just struggling to get along.
Yeah, he's a very competitive person. Back in the States, however, Robbie won the 2011 Laughlin Leap, jumping 125 feet on his first attempt. And soon we will see him in the Daytona 500.
Jumping is a motorsport?
Yeah, it's like Ken Block and all these people, driving their Subaru and this and that. Everything is a sport, man. Anytime it's moving fast and making noise, it's motorsports.
That's so especially beautiful. If it's flying.
There you go.
Excellent. Okay, let's continue.
Even if it's turning only left, it's motorsports.
Is it?
Yeah.
I thought that was something else.
No, it is still motorsports.
Okay,
Monte Carlo Rally, now part of the Intercontinental Rally Challenge, is underway. Top 9 positions at the end of day 1 were occupied by Skodas and Peugeots, with Juho Hanninen of Finlandia leading from his Skoda teammate Freddy Loa. The name like Juho Hanninen could only be from Finland, and when you have a last name as Loa, you know what that means. Thank you. Merci. Here's another Francais. Stéphane Sarrazin is fourth in his Peugeot at the end of the first day. This cat has also raced in sports cars and Formula One. Also competing in Peugeot, in another Peugeot, is another ex-F1 driver, Alex Caffey. Do you remember him?
No. He's one I don't remember, Nass. Can you bring us up to date?
Let's just put it this way. He was faster than Yuji Ide, but from Italy. He was there and raced for a few teams.
Did anybody slap him upside the head?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, good.
Yeah. He was way before Schumacher's time. Okay. But Schumacher raced for such a long time, he may have raced against him somewhere.
That's true.
Yeah. And he's back. DTM News. German Touring Car Championship hooks up with Hankook after Dunlop said Wiedersehen to the series at the end of last season. The deal with South Korean company is for 3 years. So good for Hankook.
I think it's good for DTM as well.
Yeah, and Kumho is another South Korean manufacturer, and they are the tire supplier in the Deutschen Formel 3 Championship, the German
South
ATS.
Koreans are getting in there with LG being a sponsor.
Oh, yeah, they're doing what the Japanese were doing in the 60s.
There you go.
Coming in and, slow. I mean, Hyundai now has the same reliability as Honda and Toyota.
Absolutely.
And they have some very nice lineup of cars.
Yep. My next car is going to be a Hyundai Nasser.
Really?
Yeah.
Santa Fe?
Correct.
Very good.
I think you would look more dapper in a Kia Rio.
You think so?
Yeah. My name is Rio. Yeah, that'll be good for you.
You just need to get a car in, you know, WRC or something.
They will. Trust me.
Yeah. Okay, driver signing. This is interesting. 19-year-old Spaniard Daniel Juncadea will race in F3 Euro Series with Italian Prema team. He used to race in Formula BMW and last year won an F3 race at Hockenheim with the same team. He's a pretty good racer, and he raced here in the U.S. also in certain Formula BMW U.S. Events. I met him last year, a pretty cool kid. From Spain, we go next door to Portugal, and I am very pleased to say talented driver Antonio Felix da Costa was kind enough to respond to my request for a digital dialogue. You know, we've been doing as many as we can to keep the motorsports fever going. Interviews by email.
It's like a Twitter interview.
Exactly. And we learn he is trying to get a seat in GP3 this season. Some years ago, he was hooked up with Thiago Monteiro for guidance. Last year, he was in F3 Euro Series and is taking professional guidance, like I said, from Thiago Monteiro, who is the only Portuguese, from what I can tell, who was ever on a podium, F1 podium.
With Schumacher.
Yes, and the year was 2005.
God, I love that race. It was exciting.
Oh, it was a historic event. I'm proud to be part of that. See, 20, 30 years down the road, when this race is written up in books, history books, like people could say about the 57 German Grand Prix, the 71 Italian Grand Prix, the 35 German Grand Prix, you and I can say, man, the 2005 race at the Brickyard, man, it was something.
Brickyard,
it was
I like that.
It was not just
on the... I can tell you're down home.
Oh, yeah. Back home again in Indiana. Very nice song, by the way. Lyrics are incredible.
Yeah, and the person who sings it the best is...
Jim Nabors.
Thank you very much,
Nasser. Of course. Jack Clark, 3-2. He will race in Formula 2 again this season, thus becoming one of the few drivers to have competed in all three seasons of the new Formula 2 championship. His step-papito is ex-F1 driver Julian Bailey. And I read, and again, you know, this thing is done up, written up, or at least finalized while I'm at work. But I thought what I read, that this guy is the first signing for Formula 2 this season, which is kind of surprising. But I'm sure they will fill up the grid.
Yes, I'm sure. I mean, they've just made a
and
big
we hope they do.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. And they just made a big TV deal. So I think Formula 2 is going to be okay this year.
Yeah. Oh, and talking of okay in Formula 2, remember the A1 GP?
I remember that back in the day.
I just read, courtesy of Mr. Brazier, that in Autosport magazine, that some group of investors have bought those cars, the powered by Ferrari cars, which were, I believe, designed by Rory Byrne and built in England, Bognor Regis.
Yeah, weren't they based on like the 04 Ferrari chassis?
Yeah, they are, with the V10 Ferrari engine, so they've been locked up in a shed or someplace at some auto aerodrome. So they have bought these cars, and the series will be called A10, open wheel series, A10 for 10-cylinder cars. I hope, you know, Team Pakistan comes back so I can go and cheer my homie in 19th place and hoping he will move up to 15. You got to start somewhere.
I understand, Ness, and at the back is always a good place to start.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere. Okay, Harry Tinknell, 19-year-old English chap, friend of F1 Weekly from some years ago, who discovered karting in Sardinia. Can you imagine? Kid from England discovers karting in Sardinia. And had his first single-seater experience in beautiful Button Willow in California's Central Valley. And I was there to witness that momentous occasion.
You're always at these occasions, Nasser.
Some of them. He will step up to British F3 this year with Richard Dutton's Fortec Motorsport. Last two seasons, Tinks enjoyed race-winning experience in British Formula Renault Championship. And he's one of a select few young drivers with whom I chat quite a bit on the Facebook or email, and, you know, of course it's all motorsports chat, and I get to hear a little bit of chatter and this and that and some inside scoop. I have a couple of serious inside scoop right now, but my lips are sealed as per the request of the messenger.
Scoopies.
Yeah, one of them is Formula One related. Anyway, Mr. Dutton also raced Heikki Kovalainen in days gone by. He's a huge fan of Heikki Kovalainen. Kovi used to live in his house when he was a little boy from Finland, trying to find his way in jolly old England. You know, he raced in Formula Renault and stuff like that. So he was with Mr. Dutton. Dean Stoneman, the Formula 2 champion from last year, will have to pebble his way in World Series by Renault in 2011, as he is teammate to very quick Daniel Ricciardo, the Aussie made from Perth, which is Western Australia. Ricciardo was second in World Series by Renault last year and is still in the good books of Dr. Helmut Marko. They will both race with Czech team ISR. And the Czech team is owned by a gentleman, ISR. A gentleman's name is Philippe Salaquadra, or something like that. And he's very excited that this we are the first East European team to get a full backing from Red Bull. So it's good for them. It's good motorsports is spreading all over the world. I love it. And, you know, I'm talking to some people back home, and I'm trying to be involved in setting up a karting track in Karachi. And
You're a regular humanitarian.
No, I'm willing to provide my personal and professional services expertise free of charge.
To your people?
Of course, my people. Actually, I had a meeting when I was there last time with a gentleman who was behind the effort. And he said something. The thing is, you know, every day, no matter where you go, it's all about money. And it's give me the money, and my take is this much, my take is that much. So I was talking to this gentleman. He's not short on funds to start with, but he made an interesting comment to me. He says, "I want to take this thing to the masses," and that's what you want to do if you want to promote grassroots level. So I'll see. I was actually even thinking apparently they're building a small karting track. So I was thinking of making a small donation and maybe calling it the F1 Weekly Corner or F1 Weekly Straight. You never know.
That's a good one.
Or we can even call it F1 Weekly Kart Room.
How about the host straight?
The host straight?
Yeah.
Well, that could be the food court.
Yeah.
Quiche Lorraine de Karachi.
Excellent.
Thank you. Okay, back to driver signings. Alexander Sims, another English kid who is quick, is moving into GP3 with Status Team, which is owned by Teddy Yip. This was kind of a surprise to me. This kid is pretty quick, and his papito owns some farmland here in the United States also, so they don't have any budgetary issues. And I was expecting that he would go to GP2, but he's a smart kid. I was reading his interview, and he said that, but if I go to GP3, and for whatever reason I don't make it happen, then it's over as far as Formula One is concerned. And you have to be pragmatic in this business. You know, dreams are great, but, you know, reality has to sink in before it hits you hard in the face, if you know what I mean. Feroz Fawzi, from sea to shining sea, or maybe I should say from shining Sepang to more shining Sepang, Sepang as they call it. This is my favorite. He gets fired from one Lotus, he gets hired by another Lotus. Fantastic. Malaysian driver was let go by one Malaysian-owned Lotus team, where the defendant is Tony Fernandez. And it's very sad. Almost everybody has deserted him now.
I know.
Yeah. And the Chapman family, even David Hunt, is now making statement that if he loses this case, then I would think that, you know, he kind of betrayed me. And this guy, I think, worked in good faith, and people with big money and big egos are trying to shaft him. But we'll see how it goes. But now Feroz Fawzi has been picked up as reserve driver by another Malaysian-owned team, where the plaintiff is Danny Bahar. He wants to be in IndyCars, sports cars. Maybe they might as well make a Lotus Lunar module also, you know. So we'll see how it goes. Amazing how far you can go on petrodollars. The way things are going, Formula One may become an OPEC series, if not a spec series. Pastor Maldonado kicked out Nico Hülkenberg. That's the way it is, man. Way of the world.
You need money, you need money.
Exactly.
And now Williams.
This F1 Weekly is the only institution that survives and thrives on a red accounting
budget.
On a red accounting balance sheet.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But that's okay.
It is okay.
We have the love of the listeners, and we enjoy each other's company.
That's it.
At least for 30 minutes a week. Anyway, more motorsports driver signing. Sam Byrne. This kid is good. Race winner at Monza in GP2 with ART last year, will race for iSport International, which is headed by Paul Jackson, a well-known name in motor racing. His teammate will be young Swede Marcus Ericsson, who raced last year with Supernova. Bird is in the captivity of CJ Management, and Marcus is managed by Kenny Brack. And you know, some of our listeners who are interested in classical music. Many, many moons ago, there was a very famous Romanian classical music person, Serge Celibidache. So the C is for that last name, but it's his son. But his son is involved in movie making, and they have some offices here in L.A. also. So I met one of the management partners in Abu Dhabi, and of course, we did not have credentials. So I met Sam Bird also, could not do the interview. But this managing partner told me, if you ever come to England and want to do an interview, please let us know. So we might be seeing these people in March or April, soon, hopefully. Lucas Degrassi, you remember him?
I remember.
Okay. He is hoping for an F1 return in the year 2012. I say, and again, I'm saying this because of his performance and based the things he was doing in GP2, overall package, not just a, you know, sweeping statement. I say, why bother with an inexperienced virgin when you can cross the pond and sail to success in any cars with pros like Danica and Milky? Under the Milky Way tonight. Well, you know what has happened with Milka Duno in IndyCars. They have passed a similar 107% type rule because she was running very slow, so she will be probably out of IndyCar racing. Remember the towel fight she had with Danica?
The best.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Clark thinks that she's going to end up as the reserve driver at Williams.
Because she fit in? That's the question.
She has the Venezuelan dollars behind her.
Yeah, she may have some entry into the cockpit hurdles.
They've already fixed that.
They have? Wow. Uh-huh. Okay. Force India driver situation. Rumors are spicing up in the media that Sutil, and actually Autosport of this week is reporting that Di Resta has already signed with Force India, and Sutil would be the other driver. And some reports are suggesting Nico Hülkenberg will be the third man. Lost again will be Liuzzi. He has a contract, so we'll laugh all the way to Bank of Pescara with a few million pounds or quits. But I think so many rumors have come out that I think it's going to happen that Liuzzi is out. And they'll probably buy him a seat at Virgin or send him to him. He should come to America, you know. If he has a few million dollars, that should buy him a very competitive ride in IndyCars. And he will have no problem running in the top five.
I would just stay in Pescara.
Huh? Hang out. You know, that's also Jarno Trulli's hometown.
Yeah, they could hang out, yeah. Drink wine.
Yeah, yeah. From
race each other in cars.
Jarno Trulli's winery. That's good.
That's my point.
Okay, good. Chop, chop. Barely weeks after collecting a prize for the best organized Grand Prix, boss man of Korean Grand Prix, Young Cho Chung, has received a visit from the Western Union man with an urgent message. Your services are no longer required. But wait, there's more. Nice to know, apart from $50 love hotels, they also have attorneys in Yongam. Their fees are slightly higher and satisfaction much lower, as is the case when you compare these two entities. Mr. Chung is taking his case to the court, and we will keep you posted. Any questions, any comments, Mr. Rogers, before we... I have a final segment, but just want to ask if you have anything to say.
Well, I'm glad that they have justice in South Korea.
Yeah, of course.
That's good. And also, I guess the track in China is being scrutinized and has to pass some FIA scrutiny.
They don't want any manhole cover coming
over. Something
along.
Like that. So we'll see what's going on there. But other than that, I think... I can't wait for some of the cars to come out. We're the countdown.
Yeah, motorsports is in full swing. We have the Daytona 24 Hours coming.
Your favorite?
I like that race. I like the Daytona. I've never missed a Daytona 500 since I've been here, which is 1985. I'm going to watch it again.
Keep up the good work, Nasser, and of course, a full report.
Absolutely. Finally, a quality moment from an ad done with two teammates who used to be at McLaren a few years ago. Enjoy.
Kimmy, have you ever had to take the train to work?
No.
Do you have to wear a suit for your job?
No.
Do you ever have to fix a photocopier?
A what?
A photocopier.
What is the photocopier?
I don't know.
Thanks, Nas, for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. Stay tuned for a great conversation with Nasser and Tony Brooks.
Nasser, please introduce this gentleman.
Thank you, sir. Tony Brooks, one of the legends of motor racing from the early part of the World Championship. Tony Brooks was a medical student when his passion for motor racing extracted him from being a dental surgeon. In fact, he carried his medical books to Syracuse, where he won the non-championship Syracuse Grand Prix. This made him the first British driver to win in a British car on the continent since Sir Henry Seagrave's victory in the San Sebastian Grand Prix of 1924. So there's a lot of history here. In 1958, he won the Belgian, German, and Italian Grand Prix, and these were all at classic tracks, you know, Spa, Nürburgring, the 14-mile, and Monza without the, you know, chicanes. And he was third in the World Championship. In 1959, he finished second in the championship. My sincere thanks to Mr. Tony Brooks for his time, Mrs. Brooks for hot tea, and Mr. Brazier for timely transportation. Without his help, you know, this would not have been possible. I also would like to thank Mr. Stuart Pringle of BRDC, who was kind enough to forward my request for interview to Mr. Brooks. So it was quite a global effort to make this.
Very team-oriented effort there to
absolutely
get that interview.
Yeah, I'm very thankful to all the people here, and I hope our listeners enjoy this conversation with Tony Brooks. Thank you.
And now, a moment in motorsport history, an interview with a racing legend.
Okay, I'm here in England with Tony Brooks, a British racing driver, British racing legend from the first decade of Grand Prix Formula One racing. Mr. Brooks, first of all, thank you so much. How are you today?
Well, thank you for the invitation to participate.
Before we talk about your great career, can we please get your thoughts on Britain's latest world champion, Lewis Hamilton, and the manner in which the 2008 championship was achieved on the last lap?
Well, he's obviously an outstanding driver, and you know, he was lucky to win his championship, and one can sympathise with Massa, who of course thought he'd won the championship, and I think the way he dealt with the post-race interviews was absolutely outstanding. He was really behaved like a gentleman, and a champion in prospect. So Lewis Hamilton is absolutely outstanding, but it was a lucky win, and had it started to rain 2 minutes later, Massa would have won. And I think one has to bear in mind that Massa, in fact, was robbed of two races in the Hungarian Grand Prix. It was three laps from the finish when his car packed up. And then, of course, Ferrari messed up his pit stop in Singapore. So I've got a lot of empathy for Massa, not least because I finished second in the World Drivers' Championship in a Ferrari, so perhaps I'm a little bit lacking in objectivity there. But Hamilton is, you know, an outstanding driver, no question about it. And he was in arguably the best car of the year, but he made the most of it. But he also made quite a few mistakes, so he's going to have to cut down on those if he wants to be a consistent world champion.
Sounds like you follow Formula One regularly these days. Do you, if the race is out of Europe at an odd hour, would you get up to watch it live, or how do you follow these days?
Yes, I won't get up in the middle of the night to watch it, but I'll certainly watch it recorded on 3 o'clock, and if you don't hear the news, it doesn't make any difference, really. If you don't hear the news before the race is broadcast the second time. So, yes, I follow it fairly closely. An armchair observer, and occasionally go to Monaco, but I don't attend the Grand Prix normally.
Okay. In 1955, you took a historic win at Syracuse, first British win on the continent in over three decades. Please tell us how this deal with Connaught came about.
Well, I was invited by Connaught to go and drive the car in Syracuse, and I hadn't actually ever sat in a Formula One car until the day before the race, which was the Saturday, the race being on the Sunday, the 23rd of October, I think it was. And I was invited there because I'd done one or two races in an old Formula Two Connaught, and obviously Connaught thought that I was a reasonably safe pair of hands, and gave me a chance. But I mean, in those days, October was after the end of the season, and I think there was a great shortage of suitable drivers. And I think, in desperation, frankly, they chose me because I didn't really have a. Well, as I say, I hadn't even sat in a Formula One car, so I was very lucky that they had faith in me to give me that that opportunity.
I read that when you got there, they requested do not put on a lot of miles on the car because they were more concerned about the prize money, and you only did like 12, 13 laps before the race began?
Yes, that's right. Well, they had trouble getting the cars there in time because they had, first of all, trouble with their documents when they got to Calais, or was it Dunkirk? And they also had problem in those days. The motorways didn't, the autoroutes didn't go down the length of Italy, so they were in converted green line buses, and they had quite a difficulty going over the mountain passes and so on, which they had to do in those days, reversing backwards and forwards to get round the corners and that sort of thing. So they arrived late on the Saturday. Obviously, they should have been there on the Thursday at the latest. So, so when they got there, of course. The important thing was to have the car start because the Connaughts were desperately short of money at the time, and it was the starting money which had attracted them to go to Syracuse. And literally, if you didn't start, you didn't get starting money. So the car didn't have a great reliability record, so that they didn't want me to do many laps in practice for fear of having him problems and not collecting their starting money.
And you rewarded them by winning the race at age 23. What is interesting, and I've read this many, many years ago and recently also, of course, that when you were flying to the race and coming back, you had your medical books getting ready for the exams. What was that like, and what was your plan at that time? Did you want to be a dental surgeon like your dad, or were you more interested in being a racing driver?
No, I qualified, because obviously racing driver, particularly in those days, was not... a very long career. I mean, in the 50s, there were an average of 3 to 4 drivers killed a year every year. So it wasn't really a long-term business, really. I think Stirling saw it that way, but it was the record, the track record was poor. So I always intended to finish my my dental degree, which I did in December 56. But I was studying for my... exams on the way out on the plane, on the way back on the plane, which is just as well, because it prevented me thinking too much about what I'd said I'd go and do.
Yeah. And talking of traveling, you know, nowadays everything is done by a travel agent or PR people. How would drivers make arrangements to go to continental Europe, Morocco, South America?
Well, I think the team would make those arrangements normally, and depending on your arrangements, if they were paying for your travel expenses. And they would arrange the trip for you, but maybe you have a deal whereby you pay for all expenses, hotels and everything, which goes to be down to you to make the arrangements.
Okay. You already addressed my next question, dangers in motor racing. Was there any how did your family look at it, especially parents? Were they concerned about you trying to become a racing driver, or did they encourage you?
No, my parents were very enthusiastic, and they very much encouraged me. And my mother was very disappointed when I decided to give up racing. But I think really a question of ignorance being bliss, and that I think she thought I was infallible. And unfortunately, I wasn't, and nor was any other racing driver.
You were in the tragic 1955 Le Mans race. How do you remember that day, especially after what happened there with Pierre Levay?
Well, it was a very sad day indeed, to state the obvious. And, of course, it did bring motor racing to almost a halt in 55, because all the governments reacted very badly to that, because there were 80-plus spectators killed in that accident. And so motor racing got a very bad press, and a lot of people took fright. And in fact, the Swiss never ever held another motor race after that incident at Le Mans. So it was, a very sad day for most of all the driver and the spectators involved, but also for motor racing, because it gave it a very bad image, very bad record, and resulted in a lot of races being cancelled.
Your Formula One debut in 1956 at Silverstone was not very kind to you. What went through your mind when you realized the throttle was stuck at Abbey, going into Abbey?
That wasn't my debut. My debut was, of course, Syracuse, although that wasn't a World Championship event.
That's what I mean.
But it was my first World Championship Grand Prix was at Silverstone, and the car was very quick in a straight line, but unfortunately it didn't handle. And if you went round a corner other than geometrically, it didn't like it. And if anything untoward happened, it really, you know, you couldn't do anything about it. And the accelerator stuck going into Abbey, having been repaired in the pits, because it broke. I mended it temporarily, got into the pits, lost about 7 laps whilst they're trying to fix it. And I'd been taking Abbey Curve flat, and whilst I'd been in the pits, obviously a little bit more oil and rubber had been put down. So when I went back on the circuit, I just needed a quick lift as opposed to going flat. And when I lifted my foot off the accelerator, it didn't respond, and the throttle was stuck open. And with a normal car, it would be impossible to run along the grass for perhaps, you know, 50 yards or so and edge back onto the circuit. But once you touch the grass with that car, you know, that was completely out of your control. It would spin out of control and, you know, and bounced across the circuit to the outside again and turned itself over and did the only decent thing and set itself on fire. Because it was that sort of motor car, it needed to set itself on fire. But I was very lucky to get away with just a broken jaw and a chipped ankle bone.
In 1957, you made history again with Stirling Moss at Aintree, first all Britishman in a Formula One race. In those days, you know, drivers could be called to give up. In this case, his car broke down. But how did you feel about being teammate to Moss? And I understand the team was leaning more towards him than you.
Well, it wasn't. It was prearranged that he should take over my car because I'd had an accident. My only other serious accident in my career, which was at Le Mans, and I'd been under an Aston Martin at Le Mans about 4 weeks or so beforehand, and I had tremendous abrasions and so on. And you could put a tennis ball into the hole that was in my hip. So I shouldn't have been allowed to race, but obviously you got more chance of winning if you have 3 Van Wall start rather than 2. So I agreed to start, and in fact I made second fastest time in practice to Moss. I think a couple of tenths of a second slower, but doing one fast practice lap and doing 90 laps in the condition I was, you know, just wasn't on. I mean, I couldn't have maintained. I shouldn't have been racing. And so it was arranged that if Stirling had some trouble with his car, I would bring my car in and he would take over. But he would never, ever take over my car in normal circumstances. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. You've just got to look at our respective times.
Yeah. Okay. But did you feel that the team was more interested in seeing Stirling Moss win? I've heard reports or read interviews, your interview, that you felt that you were not treated equally at Van Wall?
Yes, of course. Well, he was number one driver, and I signed on to number two, and I didn't like it. I shouldn't have signed the contract. So, yes, he had priority. He had, you know, he had the choice of engine, choice of chassis, and so on. And he ensured that he had the best car, number one driver, which obviously is much to my disadvantage. But I was in a very competitive team with virtually no track record, so I was counting myself lucky to be in the team. It was up to me to earn my stripes, as you might say, and get equal rating, which of course I did when I went to Ferrari in 1959.
In 1958, your team, Van Wall, won the first Constructors' Cup. How did you find Tony Vanderwel as team owner? He was quite a character.
Yes, he was. I mean, he was. I always got on very, very well with Tony Vanderwel, and he was a dictator, which you had to be a successful team, you know, like Ferrari with Ferrari, Enzo Ferrari with Ferrari, and Tony Vanderwel with Van Wall. And I got on very well with Tony. I think we understood each other, and I think he had quite a lot of empathy for the fact that I tended to get what was left over after Stirling had picked his engine and his chassis. But as I say, I'm not complaining. That was the deal.
Another great character of British motor racing, Colin Chapman, worked for him. When he started his team, was there any opportunity or desire or invitation from Colin to join his team?
Yes, I was invited twice in 1960 and 61, I think. Anyway, 2 years. It might have been 59 and 60. But I very politely turned him down because his cars were very fast and he was a brilliant designer, but unfortunately they had too many mechanical failures for my liking, and it was motor racing was quite dangerous enough at that time without having at the back of your mind that something might fail on the car. So very, very politely I said no, thank you.
The star driver was Jim Clark. Did you get to know him personally a little bit?
Not really, no. It was a little bit after me. I mean, we overlapped in 61, but I was driving a joke of a BRM again, you know, fancy driving twice for BRM. But I didn't see much of him, no. We were technically in the same races in 61, but he was in a competitive car and I was in an interim BRM with a second-hand Concrete Climax engine because they hadn't yet produced their own car. The BRM should have been available. The new BRM with the V8 engine should have been available at Monaco in 61. It actually appeared in practice only in Monza. So it was a great disappointment to me because the car, in fact, won the championship the following year. So I chose the right car, but I was 12 months too early.
Okay, in 1958, you won three classic Grand Prix in terms of tracks, Monza, Spa, and Nürburgring. Which track gave you the most satisfaction? Which victory, I'm sorry?
Well, I think I would, you know, put Spa and Nürburgring on a similar level because they were very different circuits, but both, you know, real driver circuits, real challenges. But you can't really, you know, compare one with the other. And but I think the greatest satisfaction I got was from winning the German Grand Prix because it was a very competitive race, and I had to pull back about, you know, 35 seconds on. Hawthorne and Mike Hawthorne and Peter Collins, having had a poor start in the race because the car was handling very badly with full petrol tanks, but as the tanks emptied, you know, the car started to handle much better. So to win a race at the Nürburgring was, you know, always a great thing, and to have the great battle with Peter and Mike, I think that I gave me more satisfaction winning the German Grand Prix in 58 than Spa. But I got, you know, Spa in some ways, I got more of a thrill driving at Spa than at Nürburgring. But as I say, they're both tremendous driver circuits, but so different, you can't really say one's better than the other. And also it depends which car you're driving at the time as to which, you know, circuit you get the most pleasure from. But Spa gave me probably the greatest pleasure, but the German Grand Prix gave me more pleasure than the Belgian Grand Prix because it was a tremendous battle with Mike and Peter.
Peter Collins was killed in this race while trying to catch you. Yes. And he was your teammate in a race before. How do you remember him as a person and a driver?
Yes.
Competitor?
Yes, well, he was very nice, a very good-looking young chap, and, of course, chased after by the girls. And I always got on very well with Peter, and he was a very, very good driver. And, of course, what happened to him took away the pleasure of the race, but when I won the race, I didn't know that it was other than, you know, just another accident, which, of course, we had only too frequently in the 50s. And I was not aware how serious it was until some hours after the race.
Yeah. In the final race, Morocco, your teammate Stuart Lewis Evans was killed, and his manager was Bernie Ecclestone then. Mm-hmm. And you had a chance to win the championship. How disappointing was it that you were not able to win the championship, Drivers' Championship?
In 58? I had a chance for the championship, yes, but of course, primarily we were trying to help Sterling to win the championship. Well, first of all, our prime objective, which we achieved, was to win the World Manufacturers' Championship. And then the second objective of the team was really to try and get Sterling to win the World Drivers' Championship. I mean, given the situation with the cars, you know, my being number two, my real opportunity to win the championship was in 59 when I, you know, had a car as good and no better than, you know, the other drivers in the team. So I finished third, I think it was, in 58. But yes, I wasn't many points behind. But I, as I say, the prime objective there was to beat Mike and to win them the manufacturers' championship, which say we did.
Do you think Van Wall would have stayed in Grand Prix racing if Stuart Lewis Evans had not been killed?
Would they have continued, Van Wall, had Stuart Lewis Evans not been killed? We shall never know, but my guess is no, because, of course, it was we'd moved into the rear-engined era, and the front-engine cars were all, you know, were really having great difficulties dealing with the rear-engine cars in 58. And I think most people could see that 59 was going to be difficult for Van Wall to repeat its success against the Coopers and Lotuses. So I think Tony Van Der Velde was probably sensible enough to realise that. And of course, it's great to quit when you're ahead. If you win the World Manufacturers Championship and you think it's going to be very difficult to repeat that, it seems to me psychologically it's a sensible thing to quit.
Okay. You mentioned the 1959 season. You were a Ferrari driver. Did you experience the world-famous Ferrari politics at Ferrari?
No, I never had any problem with Enzo Ferrari. I really didn't. And we had an Anglo-American team anyway, because Berra fell out with Ferrari. He was a Frenchman, of course. And he left the team at Reims, the French Grand Prix. And so that left Phil Hill, Dan Gurney, Cliff Allison, myself, and we got on like a house on fire. Very competitive, but on, you know, a straightforward manner. You know, great camaraderie, and very competitive, but no nonsense.
You covered my next two questions. Jean Berra, you know, apparently reports say he punched Romolo Tavoni at Reims, the race he won, and Phil Hill was second in that race.
Yes.
And he recently passed away. Can you share some thoughts on these two gentlemen, your association and friendship with them, please?
Well, no, not really. I didn't speak French. I spoke Italian, and Berra didn't seem to. He spoke Italian. I wasn't aware that he did, and it must have been fairly basic. So apart from saying hello, hi, bonjour, and so on, I didn't really have much to do with Jean Berra. And of course, Phil Hill was a super chap, and you know, a very good driver, and very simpatico, as we say, as the Italians say. And we kept in touch. I used to see them every year. Phil Hill and Dan Gurney, because we have a daughter in California, and we go over every year about Christmas time normally, not this year. And whenever we went over there, we would always have a dinner with Dan and Phil. So we very much kept in touch, and you know, he was a very warm person, and a great credit as to how he dealt with his illness, really. Absolutely an example to everybody. Top class chap.
Two more questions, please. In 1959 Sebring final race, again, you came very close to winning the championship, mm-hmm. and you had an incident with your teammate, Von Trips. Can you talk us a little bit about that, and was that a big disappointment, winning out on the championship again?
Yes, it was, but in actual fact, I lost the championship earlier in the season, in as much as Ferrari didn't go to the British Grand Prix at Aintree because of a strike at the factory. And we'd been first and second in the Aintree 200 about 4 weeks or 5 weeks beforehand. So there should have been some points there, because I finished 4 points short of Jack Brabham at the end of the year, who won the championship. And then the Spa, the Belgian Grand Prix, was cancelled, which would have been a Ferrari circuit, as opposed to the slow to medium speed circuits, which were more suited to the Lotus and Coopers. So Spa would have been a good chance for the Ferrari to win. I'd won every time I'd been to Spa, which is no guarantee, but we should have been in with a good chance there. And then at the Italian Grand Prix, I was a tenth of a second behind Sterling, who was on pole, and they challenged the clutch of the car overnight, and either didn't bed it in or fit it properly, and I did about 100 metres. And Phil Hill finished second in that race. So, again, one would reasonable to assume that we should have some points there. So then we came to Sebring, when we still had a chance of winning the championship, as did Stirling Moss and Jack Brabham. and I should have been on the front row with them, but Harry Schell was credited with a time he never did because he missed out one of the corners, and he pushed me off my front row position across the grid to the second lap, second line, and which put me in front of Van Trips. And he was busy trying to convince Ferrari that he should be a regular Formula One driver, and I think that was his first drive in a Formula One Ferrari. I may be wrong, but he was intent on trying to say, look, I should be in the team. And of course, what better way of convincing the Ferrari that he should be in the team would be to follow the team leader, as I was then, having on the basis of my results. And so he was intent on following the team leader, which he did, to the point where he shunted me up the rear on the first lap. And I came into the pits to check the car out to make sure that that there was nothing, no serious damage to it. And I lost virtually a lap in coming into the pits, and I needed to finish first in that race. And in fact, I finished third, and finished second in the championship with just 4 points behind Jack Brabham. And we both won the same number of Grand Prix. And it was the one that got away. But every racing driver's got their hard luck story, but that was a longer one than average, I think.
A final question. Watkins Glen, 1961, first Grand Prix win for Team Lotus and final race for Tony Brooks, and with a podium finish. What were the main reasons for retiring from motor racing?
Well, there isn't a simple answer to this one. It's not a sort of, it was this. It was a combination of things. I mean, first of all, I didn't have to continue with motor racing for as a career, because I had a perfectly good dental degree. The second thing was that I realised that one had to have a degree of luck to win the World Championship, which Stirling had proven pretty well. But what convinced me about the need for luck and the fact you could go on for a long time without winning the championship was in 58, Stirling and I won 3 Grand Prix each for Van Wall. He won a fourth because he went to the Argentine with Rob Walker's Cooper. So he had 4 Grand Prix, I had 3 Grand Prix, and the world champion had 1. So I thought, well, you know, funny. And then in 59, I've already explained, in 59, you know, again, it could have happened, and it didn't happen. So I realised that you needed a bit of luck on your side to win the Drivers' Championship. And the most important thing, which I should have put first, of course, is that I had married Pina and was starting a family. And as I said, I didn't have to motor race to earn a living. So whereas most of the other racing drivers didn't have a good way of earning a living apart from motor racing. And so that wasn't a valid excuse for me continuing. The next reason was that I looked at my career and said, well, it's not bad, because I'd won 7 Grand Prix, 6 of them World Championship Grand Prix. In fact, I won 50% of the Grand Prix I finished between 55 and 59, those 5 years. And it wasn't a bad record. And a good gambler quits when he's ahead. And the other factor was that they'd gone to the Formula One, had become 1.5 litres in 1961. And I mean, really, to be able to get satisfaction out of driving and to show whether in fact you're better than the guy next door, you really need a car that has more power than the chassis can handle. And those cars were, equivalent about 100 cc go-kart. They were absolutely pathetic. So it's an amalgam of those things that made me think, and I'll say, essentially, a good gambler quits when he's ahead.
Finally, would you please give a message to our listeners?
Well, thank you very much for taking the trouble to listen to a very brief summary of my career. I hope to fill out a little bit more with my own personal biography in due course. I say my personal biography because most of them are written by others, but I've been convinced against my better judgment to in fact write the whole thing myself, because I've always written my own articles. So if you want to hear more about my career, there might be something you might be interested in the future.
We are very much, and I read about this, that you have very extensive notes like Stirling Moss, maybe more. When is the book coming out, please?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got to produce it, and, you know, I've got a lot of things that take me away from, you know, from beating out the keys on my laptop. So I don't want to be committed to a date. You know, I will produce it as soon as I can, and hopefully before I'm called to some other place. But so I'm totally refused to put a deadline on it, but I am beavering away, and I shall produce it in good time.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you, Tony Brooks, for joining F1Weekly.com, and thank you, listeners.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And once again, we have no forum updates. People are still on holiday. But please check out the forum. It's fun, right, Steven?
It's fun. It's a great place to, you know, kind of get back into the swing of the season oncoming.
Yeah. And, of course, we've been getting, we have over 1,000 members now.
Ooh.
And please, no comments. Okay, quickly, we got a really fantastic email this week from Gilles Pettit. I believe he's from the UK. And I'm just going to read the first paragraph because he does go on with a lot of fantastic stuff, but I really want to just put out there that I really appreciate this email. It starts off, greetings from across the pond with hearty congratulations on your ability to cast rays of GP warmth into a cold winter void of F1. I wanted to thank you for your outstanding podcast, in particular the most recent two-parter interview with our Nige. As I listened to your roamings and ramblings through F1 past and present, I found so many connected threads that I started to wonder if you guys were working from a script. But no, it is just the loquaciousness of three friends, each with bags of passion and knowledge of the best sport on God's planet. That is just a great opening paragraph. He goes on, he enjoyed what we do in the podcast, and he had some great points. But thanks a lot for the for listening, for appreciating the hard work we do here, and thanks for the email. You know, this is the kind of things that make me go back to the microphone and do another show. And you, Nasser, too.
All by yourself?
All by myself. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what in a dark room somewhere.
No, my thanks to Gilles also. Yeah. You know, we need a little lift me up.
We do. Yeah. We do get down and out here because, you know, we're all by ourselves in the studio. And, you know, sometimes it's hard when we don't get any word from the people.
Yeah. Well, there are no pit popsies in the palatial studio.
Exactly.
Unfortunately.
Yes. So thank you very much, Gilles. Quickly, let's wrap it up. We have some calendars left, and if you want one, check out the forum. Just recently, somebody talked about the calendar, how wonderful it is, and if you don't got it, you're missing out.
You need to get it.
So exactly. So, we have some great Motorsports Memories Calendar Americana still left. Quickly, Cameron Karting is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Karting offers CRT karts, engines, and parts for all karts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California karters. For more information, just go to CameronKarting.com, and I'll remind everybody that they work out of Infineon Raceway, also known as Sears Point, and they have an outstanding karting track there. I want to mention MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter sites. Do a search for F1 Weekly and add us as a friend or click like. Also, San Francisco Formula One group, they get together during the season. They drink, they eat, and they enjoy the races. Check them out. San Francisco Formula One group, sff1.com. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email us at info@f1weekly.com. Thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.